You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning, listeners. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And you are joined today by Jacob Andrewoffer, myself, and we have...
me, Zane Alcorn. How you going?
Yeah, so just before I announce what we have coming up on the program, I'd like to acknowledge that 3CR today is being broadcasted to you from Wurundjeri land. We acknowledge that this of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge that this always was and always will be Aboriginal land and that sovereignty has never been ceded. 3CR and Green Left Radio is committed to supporting decolonisation and all struggles of First Nations people all over the world globally. So, just to give a bit of a rundown on what we have coming up on our program, we actually have two interviews kind of booked, which are going to be actually looking at some of the things that have been coming out of the Watson Report against the kind of CFMEU. And this is very much going to be a program that these interviews were very much going to be kind of, you know, giving a bit of an alternative kind of perspective of the kind of the whole kind of narrative that is coming out from the corporate media about the CFMEU. Because 3CR, you know, we're proudly, and Green Left Radio, we're proudly a program that attempts to kind of put forward the kind of alternative to kind of the capitalist press. You know, the forced administration of the CFMEU is very much a grave injustice and very much a massive attack on working people and their right to organise. Yeah, so we'll be speaking to Sue Ball, who just recently published an article looking at this issue and basically looking at Geoffrey Watson's CFMEU report to the Queensland, basically, you know, arguing that this is an attack on all unions. And then we also have maybe you want to tell you a bit about Saul.
Yeah, so we've got independent economist from Tasmania, Saul Eslake, who, frankly, listeners, is not the kind of person that you'd probably usually listen to on 3CR. Saul is more of a mainstream economist, I would say a sort of more progressive liberal economist. But there was an article in The Guardian recently, and unlike most of the mainstream coverage of Geoffrey Watson's absurd claim that CFMEU members and or organised crime around them pocketed $15 billion off the big build, The Guardian actually questioned that number rather than taking it as gospel true, which is what most politicians and media outlets, including disgracefully the ABC, have done. They've just taken that $15 billion figure as a given. Saul Eslake was quoted in that Guardian article questioning that, and his methodology was to look at some Australian Bureau of Statistics data. So we'll talk to Saul after 8 o'clock, and we'll get him to explain the methodology behind those statistics. And Saul himself, when I wrote to him and asked if he could come on this morning, he was sort of said, well, he was a little bit surprised when he looked into that and found those numbers. So yeah, it's going to be good to talk to Saul and get his take on things, because, I don't know, it's a bit of a different voice to what we'd normally be listening to here on 3CR, but I think his economist testimony is quite compelling.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to this interview. Now, let's go on to, I think for the start of the program, I wanted to kind of cover, and I will be also playing a recording of a talk by Guy Galore, who is part of Anti-Zionism Australia. This was from basically a public forum that was organised by Socialist Alliance and Green Left on Tuesday, the 24th of February, which had been recorded for 3CR. So we'll be playing a bit of recording of that talk a bit later. But the first story I kind of wanted to talk about is very much wanted to go on. I wanted to go cover a few headline stories that have been kind of happening in the past week. And the first story I want to kind of talk about is, I guess this is an issue that has been, that's sort of been publicized and a bit, and it's been a big subject of public debate. And that is the issue of ISIS brides. Now, these, to give you a bit of a background to this, the kind of so-called ISIS brides are essentially a group of women who went to Iraq and Syria to marry and raise children of fighters for ISIS. Now, there's a lot of complicated issues with this, and that is the fact that there is, at least in northeast Syria, there is currently 11 women and 23 children who are basically stuck in a camp within Syria, and essentially there is a big kind of whole open kind of discussion about the fact that, you know, a lot of these women and children are essentially Australians. I mean, they are by all rights Australian kind of citizens. But essentially, there's this whole public debate, and it's linked to Islamophobia. It's linked to a lot of the kind of concerns about the far right, about, you know, terrorist sort of infrastructure and so on. So there's basically this whole big public debate. And also, one thing I want to kind of note as well is these women and children are currently being held in northeast Syria, which is where, you know, which is around that where the kind of Rojava kind of experiment is sort of taking place. And within the perspective of the political forces within Rojava is that these women and children should actually be basically should be taken back, replicated and brought back home to Australia. But there is a number of things that are being put forward, and in fact, Albanese shamefully has basically made his contempt for these so-called ISIS brides, but basically saying that the woman made their bed and they must now lie in it. Now, a few things to kind of unpack here. I mean, at the end of the day, okay, these women could be guilty of crimes. They could be, but the reality is, if they are guilty of crimes, they actually should be trialed in a court of law. Because at the end of the day, the group, the people who are trapped in these camps are mostly children who actually have, who are guilty of essentially no crimes other than the fact that, you know, their parents might have committed, you know, might have been linked to a radical Islamist group. And I think it's quite disgraceful that the Albanese government, when really they are legally obligated to bring these people back home, because at the end of the day, they're Australian citizens who are essentially stranded in northeast Syria. But really, what Albanese is really saying is he's essentially just, in the context of the rise of support for One Nation, and One Nation's raising a lot of noise about how we should not bring these people back to Australia, they are essentially just, catering to the kind of One Nation kind of politics. Because very much I can see it, because at the end of the day, the Albanese government is so opportunistic. It has no principles whatsoever. They're probably just making the calculation that, you know, at the end of the day, it's like 33 or 24 people, you know, We can't risk the political heat we're gonna get from One Nation and the right wing for bringing these women back. And also, I think another thing that also has to be said is this idea that these women are just, you know, automatically kind of guilty, I think is also just missing the political context. I mean, there's a story that's going around in the ABC that, you know, one of the women who is part of the ISIS brides, you know, was conceivably coerced into coming into to northeast Syria by her husband.
Well, I think it's not just conceivably coerced. The woman's name is Kirsty Ross Emile, and there's a story about her in an ABC website. She was 14 years old when she was convinced to go and join ISIS and be part of an arranged marriage. Now, if that happened within Australia's borders, that would rightly be described as pedophilia. She's a 14-year-old, and she's been convinced to marry an adult man who was 20 years older than her. So under Australian law, that girl would rightly be seen as open to being misled by an adult who has... There's a substantial power imbalance there. And we know that the particular interpretation of Islam that ISIS subscribed to is a highly toxic and misogynist one. So I think that the Labor Party wants to have it both ways. They want to put on their kiddie gloves and give One Nation a free pass and sort of say, oh, you know, we're civilized, democratic people here in Australia, and Muslims are bad and scary, and women have no rights. They want to try and portray white Western culture as, inherently liberatory for women, and Islamic culture as inherently oppressive to women. And yet when you have a 14-year-old girl who has been groomed into going over to Syria and getting drawn into the vortex of ISIS, all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, that was her choice. She didn't that. So it's not just the fact that there's kids over there who are not old enough to be found guilty of committing terrorism. Those kids are still under the care of adults, and you can't treat them like you would treat an adult. And it's also the case that some of those, at least one of those women who's over there, was a girl when she was groomed into traveling to Syria and joining what was no doubt portrayed to her as this exciting and, you know, special experience of being part of something, you know, profound, like under this, you know, weird interpretation of Islam that the Salafis subscribe to. So, yeah, the double standards of saying Western liberal culture is really good for women and Islam is bad for women. Okay, if that's the case, bring these people home. You can't have it both ways. You can't say, oh, us here in the West, we're really fair to women, and then be like, oh, except them. They're bad. And now they have to become non-citizens, stateless people.
Well, it's also quite apparent that as well is like, you know, Australia loves to kind of go on about, you know, basically loves this idea of like that we, you know, if you're born in Australia, no matter what happens to you overseas, you know, Australia will always be out there to look out for you. But of course, they always seem to somehow find exceptions to this, because at the end of the day, legislatively, Australia is actually obligated to look after its own citizens. Mm. And all these, these women and children are by all rights Australian citizens. Mm. But of course, yeah, conveniently, that gets thrown out of the window because they want to cater to some far right, this far right wing political sentiment that's being brewed up by One Nation and the Liberals.
Yeah, and you can just imagine the sort of hollow man political consultants in the inner circle of the Labor Party whispering in the ears of all these Labor politicians, like, "Oh no, we've got to cast them away and keep them over there, because otherwise One Nation are going to have a field day and call us terrorists. So it's the, or call us kowtowing to terrorists. So yeah, absolutely cowardly the way that these people are fodder in Labor's small target policy of not wanting to be seen to help terrorists or something. The other thing is, since September 11, there's been this massive establishment of a Stasi-like surveillance state in Australia to monitor against terrorism and preemptively protect against terrorism, blah, blah, blah. And if these people are repatriated, as they should be, then there'll be all this monitoring happening. So again, the idea that these people pose some sort of danger is, I think, just ridiculous. They're going to be monitored to within an inch of their life once they're back here, if they get returned, which they should be. And it would be good to see the community speaking up more about this.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I just want to I can't give up a kind of opportunity to to criticise Albanese again, but there was another kind of funny story which kind of shows another element of spinelessness from Albanese. So basically, Anthony Albanese was essentially on one of these a News Corp show where he was sort of asked to kind of play a word association game. Now, it was sort of funny. He was asked a question about Grace Tame. Many people would know Grace Tame. She was named 2021 Australian of the Year as an advocate for survivors of sexual assault. But Grace Tame, you know, to her credit, has also been a very outspoken about Palestine. Mm. And in fact, has actually invited the ire of a lot of the right wing, who have actually called on Grace Tame to have her Australia of the Year award rescinded, especially because she very much spoke out in support of the slogan "Globalise the Intifada" at a protest in Sydney, and that was at the height of the New South Wales police repression. That was at the protest against Isaac Herzog. Now, it was very funny. I actually watched the whole clip last night, you know, because Albanese's asked Grace Tame, and then he sort of says, because the funny thing is, He was allowed to use more than one word, and he had to use more than one word for some other associations. But it's very telling that the first word that he said in response to Grace Tame in terms of this word association was difficult.
Hmm.
And
he could have said staunch or champion or legend.
Yeah, yeah. Like there's all these other words he could have used, but then he said difficult. And then he was followed up by asking a question about Donald Trump, and he said presidential or something like along those lines. And then he was asked, and he would say, oh, well, I would say that again next year. So basically, I mean, clearly a lot of like deliberate kind of sucking up to the Trump administration, even when he's having a bit of fun. Now, what is obvious is that there was clearly understandable backlash from women. Even a liberal woman was actually quite a bit outraged. You know, had a bit of outrage towards Albanese because she sort of related to this kind of experience like this. Because at the end of the day, it is a very sexist thing that is often outspoken women often get called difficult by men in powerful kind of positions. Mm. And, you know, very much the use of language that Albanese used very much kind of reflected that. Now, what's even worse is that Albanese was asked to kind of clarify these comments, and he said, oh, no, I didn't actually mean difficult in that way. I just meant that she had a difficult life. I'm like, yeah, that is very convenient. At the height of the fact that Grace Tame has been facing a lot of controversy for her so-called controversial views for speaking up about Palestine, for someone who's really shown no real support for Palestine, and, you know, yes, you that's totally what you meant. And then, of course, he also has to in his clarifying comments, he also says, well, yeah, I also disagree with a lot of Grace Tame's comments, especially about Palestine. You know, it's kind of very convenient. And, I mean, it just sort of shows how kind of spineless Albanese is. I definitely liked Grace Tame's response, who said basically did not accept Albanese's apology and basically compared Albanese to
ScoMo.
ScoMo, who treated Grace Tame in a very similarly kind of patronising kind of way.
Mm. Yeah. And it's same again, whether we're talking about the ISIS brides coming home or this, just these kind of pathetic, weaselly, small target approach to damage minimization rather than, you know, being honest and being like, yeah, I said it and it was a bad thing to say and I shouldn't have said it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also just shows as well, like, you know, within the state of Australia, it kind of doesn't matter if you win an Australian the Year award. It seems that if you start to speak out against the general consensus of the ruling class and of what is considered respectable opinion within so-called Australia, you're going to be treated in a very patronising and condescending way by the establishment.
Hmm. But yeah, it's bloody good to see Grace Tame getting out there, speaking at Palestine rallies and, pushing back. She's, an inspiring example of not being pushed into a corner or put in a box. And, much respects to Grace.
Yeah. And I think, this program would absolutely love to extend all the solidarity to Grace Tame as she's facing all these attacks from the establishment for her, you know, for a staunch advocacy for Palestine. All right. I'm just going to go play a quick few announcements. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM.
Because the Palestinian fight isn't just the Palestinians' fight, it's all our fight, because it's a fight not just about land, it's about a fight for freedom.
Everybody should be standing here today saying, Free Palestine.
Solidarity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters on behalf of the Gumbanja Nation, my people who've never ceded their sovereignty.
We should be recognising Palestine as a state and recognising the rights of Palestinians.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
The media in this country, we as Indigenous people know, have censored our right of telling the truth, and the truth is what this country is most fearful of, in particular Indigenous truths. Until history is told by the vanquished lens, which is our people telling our story our way, and have the right to be able to incorporate that into a system of learning, well, people are always going to be denied that truth by deceit and lies. When you look at the type of psychological warfare and spiritual warfare that Aboriginal people are caught in, it's not just in the sense of military when they talk about weapons of mass destruction, but you're right, it's in terms of the media and the industry of media as a warfare against our people, and so is religion, I believe, in the Western sense. They're all weapons of mass destruction against our people.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
Okay, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And I thought we'd actually play a bit of a song. And I was going to play a song from Momoko Gill. And basically, this is taken from Matt Ward's album wrap-up that he's just published actually yesterday for the pages of Green Left. And this is from the 10 new albums for A World in Crisis. And he basically writes about Momoko Gill that this is very much, she very much is a pro-Palestine kind of musician. She's also a jazz, she's a jazz drummer, and humanizing the Palestinians is very much part of the big, a big part of her new album. And I was going to play the song When Palestine Is Free, which will be, yeah, we'll go, we'll play for the next, 5 minutes. And so, yeah, hope listeners enjoy. This is When Palestine Is Free by Momoko Gill. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
Have we come to see we're only free when Palestine is free? Every light we grieve returns to heal the river to the sea. Have we come to see we're only free when Palestine is free? Long as we may breathe, we turn to heal the river to the sea. No more rest in peace.
All right, that was actually a very good track, actually. So it was that was by Momoko Gill, and it's from her album Momoko. And this was the number one album that's featured on Matt Ward's album wrap up, which was published just yesterday in Cultural Dissent on the pages of Green Left. So I definitely recommend listeners checking out the rest of the albums that are promoted and artists that are promoted in that article. So
He's done it again, Matt. He's found some absolute gold. What glorious activist jazz.
Yeah.
What a vibe.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, I'm just going to go play a quick announcement. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM.
The law is part of our everyday lives, including when we buy something, use a service, have a job, or rent a house. The law can be used to help protect and support families when there is violence in the home or disputes over parenting arrangements. Sometimes we might need to understand the law to navigate specific government systems like Centrelink, getting a residency visa, or if we come into contact with the police. Community legal centres provide free, quality legal advice and assistance to help people with everyday legal problems. We focus on working with people who are experiencing disadvantage, such as financial hardship, family violence, homelessness, and discrimination. Community legal centres are independent, non-government organisations and can be found across Victoria and Australia. If you're experiencing a legal problem, your local community legal centre may be able to help. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres Victoria at www.fclc.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio. And so for the next part of the program, I was going to play a talk by Guy Galore. And this is a talk basically, Guy Galore is an activist with Anti-Zionism Australia. And this is a talk that he gave at the public forum speaking up for genocide, why Labor is cracking down on dissent. And it was organized by Green Left and Socialist Alliance and featured a whole panel of kind of speakers. What I found interesting about Guy's talk is it gives quite a different perspective on anti-Zionism. And Guy is also someone who had actually had the experience of being born in Israel and had kind of, you know, basically had been raised in a Zionist sort of family and had kind of broken away from Zionism and is now a very staunch supporter for Palestine. But yeah, you'll get a bit of sense of that from Guy's talk. So yeah, hope listeners enjoy it. And it goes on just for the next 9 minutes.
For the important, very clear words. And I'd like to also join the acknowledgement that we are meeting on unceded Wurundjeri Woiwurrung land. And acknowledge the deep connection between always having that in the forefront of our mind and the topics that we're discussing here today. So I'm here as a member of Anti-Zionism Australia, and I'll tell you a little bit about our little organization or little group. Really, we're not really defined in any clear way, at least not yet. We're more like a collective of activists that got together last year after we realized that in our view there needs to be another voice that supports all of the existing strong voices within the excellent a Palestine movement that has really been the one ray of light in the last couple of years of darkness. But we also realize the increasing attacks on the basic legitimacy to stand up against Zionism as an ideology and as a practice. We know that there is a lot of Jewish anti-Zionist organizing, and some of us in the in anti-Zionism Australia are either identify as Jewish or come from Jewish backgrounds. But we wanted to organize against anti-Zionism in a way that doesn't seek its legitimacy from Judaism. Because in a way, while that is very important and we support and we have some of our members are also active in groups such as Loud Jewish Collective and Jewish Council of Australia, there is also, if we only talk about anti-Zionism from a sort of a quote-unquote Jewish perspective, we really sort of play into the idea that Zionism is an inner Jewish matter, whereas it's really not. And even though I came from that, from a Jewish cultural background, my position on Zionism doesn't come from Judaism, it comes from humanism. And it comes from my overall sort of politics and ethics. So I guess that's the little nuance, and what we want to bring is really to help keep the anti-Zionism as a movement and as a voice alive and strong, and also to bring more education and understanding of what is anti-Zionism and the history of Zionism from the anti-Zionist perspective. So I'm very happy to speak from my experience being born and raised within occupied Palestine with all the privilege of being Jewish in that context. So I'm very happy to speak from that perspective. However, my anti-Zionism is not coming from any religious sort of context, but very much from a secular humanist globalist perspective. And we're going to do, and I think the main activity that we're going to do this year is a series of seminars about understanding Zionism from an anti-Zionist perspective. And it the idea came from the excellent series of seminars that Yusuf Al-Rimawi is doing of understanding Palestine, which you might be aware of, and if not, then I strongly recommend looking that up. It's run by Averos, the center. And then with also with Yusuf's support, we decided to sort of complement understanding Palestine with the sort of understanding Zionism. So that's going to be on Sundays, ones that don't clash with Yusuf's classes. And the first one is going to be on 29th of March. It's going to be a bit of a panel. And we also have a few international speakers that might do some seminars. So stay tuned. There's really a lot of things that I can talk to you about, but I wanted to talk to, I guess, about a couple of things. One is understanding the our objection to the hate speech laws, and I feel like the crowd here would have a very strong understanding of why it erodes democratic and due process, why it undermines anti-racism when we focus on the presumed safety or feeling of safety of one group of people on the expense of other groups of people that does not add to any social coherent, and that undermines anti-racism. Anti-racism has to be a complete approach. Really, the thing is, for the important, very clear words, and I'd like to hate laws is that if you apply them equally, then Zionism should be outlawed. because Zionism, as an ideology, it is based on the idea of supremacism, that some people have inherent rights just because of their blood, and the definition of Judaism under Israeli law mirrors the one under Nazi Germany. So you need to prove to have one quarter parents Jewish, etc., and then you can get the full citizenship rights, while millions and millions of people are refugees and second, third, fourth generation refugees that are barred their basic rights. And as you know, Israel is continuing in its process of the physical and ideological erasure of Palestinians. And we see this process now spread around the world. And whether it's the physical destruction, we know that it has been enabled by not just by Israel's closest ally, but really by the global network of industry, of capitalism, and really of neocolonialism, which has its own ongoing interest to enable and normalize these processes of the dismantling of international concepts of human rights and rule of law and all of those sort of ideas and structures that came out from the Second World War. So really, we feel that our rejection of Zionism is really everyone's business, and especially at this time when there is such a strong attack on the basic right to organize in that way. And we can really see how that basic delegitimization and the same patterns of ideological attack that I remember from 20, you know, from 30 years ago when I was a teenager starting to get into activism in occupied Palestine, and we now see those same patterns again of just the slow erosion of rights. And I might just finish with something, with maybe I'll throw in a bit of controversy or just challenging idea, which is I feel like we are really trapped here. Because whenever there is a labor government, and I know that this is really the sort of topic here, it seems to be almost impossible to organize against it, because it seems like the main or the major unions are in the pocket of the Labor Party, and that gives them carte blanche to do whatever they want. And to be honest, I don't know strategically if it's right to continue to put labor over liberal in the ticket. I think in the next one I'm considering not putting any of the major parties. I think I'd rather my voice not be counted than counted to Labour. And to be honest, I don't know, I'm not convinced that politically, federally, there is an advantage for us to have Labour over Liberal, especially because of the political impact it has on stifling opposition. Because I feel like if it was a Liberal government, then the unions would have been much more on the front foot with opposing it, especially opposing the attacks on free speech. I don't know if that's the right thing to do, but I thought I'll kind of throw it out. And that's my personal thought. That's not a Nezadeh line or anything. So that's really my own sort of thoughts. And would happy to hear what you think of it, because I feel like we're just kind of trapped, and I don't know what is the right strategy for us to get over that labor union stifling of building a right opposition.
All right, you were just listening to Guy Glore, who was part of speaking on a public forum on speaking up for genocide, why Labor is cracking down on dissent, which took place on February 24th, and it was organised by Green Left and Socialist Alliance. Now, we're very happy to be joined by our first live guest for the program. We're joined today by Sue Bull, who is a member of Socialist Alliance, regular writer for Green Left, and also was a former CFMEU trainer. So, Sue Bull had recently wrote an article looking at the Watson Report, which was an inquiry given on the CFMEU following their forced kind of administration by the Albanese government. Sue kind of had quite a good read of the Watson Report and actually came to, I guess, a number of kind of conclusions about it. So, yeah, so good morning, Sue.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, you're good to that. Now, Sue, I wanted to kind of hear from you, what can you tell us about the Watson Report and why it's a kind of attack on the union movement?
Well, Well, it was written by Jeffrey Watson, who was originally employed by the CFMEU just before they were taken into administration in response to the Building Bad expose that a number of journalists had got together on The Age and other sources, media. And those Building Bad claims basically made out that the CFMEU was endemically corrupt and had been involving itself with gangsters and bikies on the big build, which is all of the Victorian infrastructure. So Jeffrey Watson was taken on to help the union investigate itself. But only a very short time later, all of the legislation put forward by the Albanese government came into force, and that put the union under administration. And so everything that the union was doing was then run by the administrator, his name is Irving. And essentially, Watson then was taken on as a consultant by the Irving administration, and he became accountable to them. Now, a year and a half ago or so, he put out an interim report based on his interviews of 15 organisers, where they had been told to speak to Watson. And it was clear from that interim report, which I read really closely, that he had either very little understanding of how the building industry actually operated or was deliberately misrepresenting it. And you could see it in his so-called analysis of how enterprise bargaining agreements come into force. He was making out that shop stewards or union reps on the site, which he labelled as officials, but they're clearly employed by the bosses and elected on the site. He was making out that they were forming the EBAs, and therefore that was a point of corruption. And when this first report came out, a lot of us criticised that for a complete misrepresentation of what happens on site and the EBA process. And he admitted that he'd never got back to the 15 organisers he'd interviewed and never checked his sources, but he put that report out anyway. And it seems in the period that followed, he then did this much more significant report, which came out in the Queensland Commission of Inquiry a week and a half or 2 weeks ago. And it's that one that's done the big damage, because it's that one that makes out that the union ripped off the big bill by $15 billion, even though that was cut out of the report. So there's a lot of political attack in this particular one. So, yeah, that's the background.
Yeah. That $15 billion figure, we're going to be talking to Saul Eslake about that, but I'm keen to hear your thoughts on that number. There's 30,000 CFMEU members.
Yeah.
$15 billion. That's like $500,000 per CFMEU member out of big build. Well, I'm a CFMEU member. I don't have my $500,000. Do you have yours?
No, me neither. Oh. And I'm still a member. So this figure was cut out of the report, not just redacted, cut out of the report by Irving, because he said it was unsubstantiated. He didn't then mention that an awful lot in the report is unsubstantiated and guilt by association, but never let the facts get in the way of a good story. So the $15 billion is Watson's estimation of the amount that corrupt CFMEU forces alongside of gangsters have ripped off the big bill. It's totally unsubstantiated. It's a complete guess, but somehow or other, the media gets hold of it, I presume because it came up in the Queensland Inquiry, and then that's the thing that they're running with. So, it's tragically a real smear campaign, and we know that it's had an impact. Well, we know the whole report's had an impact, because members have been being abused on the street. So it's starting to actually really bite people. even though even he can't substantiate that figure.
I want to go into kind of another question, and you kind of write in your article that, you know, basically one kind of thing about the Watson kind of report is it doesn't really provide any kind of balanced account of the building industry, and very much kind of pushing the idea that the CFMEU is not a trade union, but rather a crime syndicate. Do you want to kind of unpack that bit?
Sorry, I might have missed a little bit. That not a trade union, but a corruption centre.
Yeah, yeah, that was one of the things about, and it but it doesn't provide any balanced account of the building industry.
No, it doesn't. So this is a union that within a you know a 20 year period or so, helped to quarter the number of deaths on building sites. So a lot of its real impetus over the last 20 years has been in terms of safety, but also in terms of raising pay and working conditions substantially, and very much in Victoria, but certainly nationwide, and has set the pace for all other unions. That's the CFMEU is represented. So you can see that there's a lot of different enemies to gain from making certain that the CFMEU is seen as a corrupt force and therefore trying to pull it down. And we're not denying that there may not be some issues, and very serious issues. But if that's the case, then why haven't more people been convicted or,
Yeah, you just dropped out a little bit there. Why haven't more people been convicted or charged?
Yeah, charged on the evidence that Watson says he has, which has not been the case. He hasn't taken any of that evidence to the police. And, you know, and then we find out that the Victorian government's done very little about the allegations either. So all round, there's been very, very little actual investigation, just a lot of slurs. So we're not against, you know, the union being investigated or individuals being charged, but that hasn't actually been the case. It's all been used politically. So it's within the right-wing's agenda to make certain that the union appears to be absolutely criminally corrupt so they can hand over the work we do to other unions that will not be prepared to fight as hard as the CFMEU has done.
Now, Sue, can you comment on the way admin is portrayed as going in and weeding out criminal elements? But the reality has been that scores, dozens of, if not huge numbers of really committed, respected union organisers and staff have either been sacked and made removed persons who can never work for the CFMEU or any other union ever again unless they get delisted. And then in parallel to that, the threat of being made a removed person has been used to discreetly push people out and make them sign non-disclosure agreements in the hope that maybe one day at least they won't be a removed person, they can get a job in the union again after this is all finished. So can you comment on the disconnect between what we're told admin is doing versus the reality on the ground where they're just sending a wrecking ball through the union?
Yeah, see, you can see it really dramatically in Queensland and New South Wales where the staff has been not only sacked, like over one-third of the staff, in some cases two-thirds of the staff have been sacked, but then replaced not necessarily with people from the industry, but with, you know, hacks from the ACTU. That's essentially what's happened. So you can see that that's really taking hold in some of the other states. In Victoria, huge numbers of organisers have been told to go, or else they'll be investigated. That's essentially how it's been working. But interestingly, the officials that remain have fought really hard to make certain that they're going to be replaced with young workers from the industry. which that's, you know, that's something we need to actually support the local leadership on, because if they can do that, they might be able to stop some of the takeover from forces that are in opposition to the union. Look, that remains to be seen. The union in Victoria, the office has been gutted, and they're having real difficulty trying to stay on top of it. They're doing pretty amazing effort, actually, but they're having real difficulty remaining on top of it. And it's all about trying to make certain that the CFMEU is no longer the militant union that it was.
And Sue, can you also comment on the double standard? Geoffrey Watson, in this report, criticises the CFMEU for failing to stop like criminal contractors from operating. Like, the construction industry is up there with casinos historically as a place that organised crime has been known to try and wash money, because you can bring in cash, you can pay people cash, and you can try and, you know, wash your ill-gotten criminal gains and come out the other side of it with a legitimate investment property that you then sell. So yeah. since time immemorial, organised crime has gravitated towards the construction industry, and that has been a real challenge. Why isn't Geoffrey Watson, like, he'll bag out the CFMEU for apparently not taking action, as if the union has got the coercive powers of the state to somehow shut down businesses run by, you know, dodgy operators. Why isn't Watson calling for companies who are known to have set CFMEU organisers' cars on fire or bash CFMEU organisers? Why isn't he calling for those private companies to be put under administration?
Oh, look, you can only guess, to be perfectly honest. But to me, it's a political setup. You know, they're not interested in stopping the bosses. It's the bosses that pay for these alleged corrupt and gangsterish forces as you know, fixes. They're not paid by the union ever. They're paid for by the bosses. And there's never been any evidence in anywhere. Remember, this is the third time. We've had two Royal Commissions into the CFMEU in the last 20 years. They've never found any of those links. So this is the third time we've had a massive investigation. And all of those links are...
Sorry, so you just dropped out again. All of those links are...
those elements, not the CFMEU. So you can only put it down to a concerted political attack. It's a political agenda. And now you've got Liberal Party forces, you know, really conservative forces pushing it. They can smell blood, you know. The Yellen government might come down through all of this, and this could be Albanese's legacy, is that the administration of the CFMEU might pull down a state-elected Labor government.
Absolutely. Anyway, Sue, we've probably got to wrap up this interview because we've got to make time for the next interview soon. Do you have any kind of final comments you'd like to end on?
I think that all progressive forces have to come out in support of the union. You know, by all means, if there's problems, let's clean them up. But in reality, this is actually a huge hit job being done on probably the most significant union in recent history in Australia. It's horrific to watch.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much for going on the program, Sue. And yeah, just apologies to our listeners for some of the sound issues in that interview. Sue Ball is actually travelling to Melbourne at the moment by train. I think it was a great interview regardless. So thank you very much, Sue, for being on the program.
Yeah, thanks very much.
All right. So we might have a quick announcement and then head to the activist calendar.
The work cover system is broken. Delays, denials, and profit-driven decisions are hurting real people physically, mentally, and financially. add your support to the Call for Change by the Injured Workers Support Team. Visit the Parliament of Victoria website, find the Legislative Reform for Workers' Compensation System e-petition, and add your name. Stand with the IWST and injured workers. Demand a system that is centred on recovery, dignity, and safety. Sign the petition today. IWST is a 3CR supporter.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. So now it is time for the Green Left Activist Calendar. So tonight, there's actually quite a lot of different events sort of coming up. So there's a online discussion about capitalism, socialism, and socialist alliance at 5:30 PM online, and you can find out more information about that on the Green Left website. In Melbourne, there's going to be a rally. Genocide is a crime, protest is not, and that's going to be happening at 5:30 PM at the State Library of Victoria, and it's been organised by Students for Palestine. Then there will be a film screening in Box Hill, Nalia and the Uprising, and that'll be happening at 6 PM at the Box Hill Library, 1040 Whitehorse Road in Box Hill. Then there will be the Radical Book Club hosted by Green Left and Socialist Alliance titled Unpacking Trump's Attack on Venezuela's Sovereignty, and that'll be happening at 7 PM at the Resistance Centre, level 5407 Swanson Street in the city. Then on Saturday, February 28th, there'll be the Stepping Razor Reggae Rocksteady Soul Hip Hop Dub and Dance Hall for West Papua, and they'll be happening at 4 PM at the Hard Out Plenty Road in Preston. Actually, I can't advertise this because actually it's been sold out, but on Wednesday, March the 4th, there was an event with Yanis Varoufakis and friends at the Edge Federation Square. But yeah, the event is sort of sold out, so. But just to let you know, that is actually happening. On Friday, the 6th of March, there'll be the International Women's Day rally at 12 PM at the Trades 4, 54 Victoria Street in Carlton. And then there'll be a conference on Saturday, March the 7th, International Women's Day for and by trans women at 10 AM. Also on Saturday, March the 7th, there'll be a fundraiser, Iftar for Gaza, and that'll be happening at 7:30 PM at the Schoolhouse Studios, 28 Victoria Street in Coburg. On Tuesday, March the 10th, there'll be a public forum, Capitalism's War on Women, which will be happening at 6:30 PM at the Resistance Centre, level 5407 Swanson Street in the city. And then on Wednesday, March 11th, there'll be the nationwide student strike for Palestine at 2 PM at the State Library. Now, just the last event I'll just highlight is basically there's going to be a rally, Prepare for the March in March for Forests, and that'll be happening on Sunday, March 22nd at 11 AM at the Parliament Gardens in Albert Street in the city. All right, so that's the activist calendar. Oh, I also forgot to note there'll be the Degrowth Festival at 11 AM at the Curtin Square at the Raftown Street in Carlton, in Carlton South.
Word. All right, well, can we play another song from Matt Ward's compendium?
Oh, yeah.
His monthly compendium.
Well, yeah, I'll just play a quick announcement while I'll quickly get that together. You're listening to Green Left Radio. And also, just one thing to kind of note, it's also the 3CR subscriber drive. You know, to kind of bring you the kind of news that 3CR kind of brings you kind of every day. It really relies generously on the support that that our subscribers give financially. So if you love what 3CR brings to you to the air every day, consider becoming a subscriber. And you can become a subscriber by going on freecr.org.au/subscribe. So
yeah, and it's $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 if you're a band or an organisation, and $300 solidarity. And yeah, it's like paying your union dues. This is a member-based community radio station, and that's how we keep going and bringing you radical perspectives, excellent news, and, you know, the whole diversity of really cool programs here on 3CR. So please do subscribe and keep it ticking along.
Being a 3CR subscriber is vitally important to keeping us community-controlled, grassroots and on-air 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Every 3CR show is a progressive voice that enriches and informs our communities.
From gardening and music to current affairs and First Nations voices, we broadcast expert community knowledge, offering perspectives beyond the mainstream media.
Subscribe today to be part of community-owned and community-controlled media.
Show your solidarity. Subscribe.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 9419 8377.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In Naam, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
Okay, we're gonna. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. So, for this is another from another album taken from Matt Ward's 10 albums roundup. I'm gonna be playing Clara by Hen Ogledid. You're listening to Green Left Radio, and hope listeners enjoy. And well, I'm looking forward to listening to this, especially how great the last song we played from the wrap up was.
The path yesterday gone farther and farther away. Call her Clara.
Disco.
Riding through the springtime. Call her Clara.
Disco.
Yn edrych am y ceffil di o Abereiron i Lanon y ffach mae cwymp mawr i lawr i'r môr ger Abera Mae twll yn y pryd yn Alltwalus 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 E taflaf ym Mhryderon. Mm-hmm.
can spoil from minuteless toil a shimmering puddle of oil. I can't see my face. Look here in this mirror. The skin on my skull, it grows thinner. Call her Clara.
I had a wee sister, they called her Peep Peep. She waded the waters so deep, deep, deep. She climbed up the mountain so high, high, high. And poor little thing, she had but one eye.
All right, you're just listening to Clara by Hen Ogledead. From Matt Ward's sort of roundup, and they actually, if you thought the music was interesting, it's sort of defined as experimental kind of folk and avant-garde. But yeah, I thought it was quite a interesting kind of track. I'm now going to go pass it on to Zane because we now have our second live guest for the program.
Yes. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and this morning we have Saul Eslake. Saul is an independent economist, consultant, speaker, and Vice Chancellor's Fellow at the University of Tasmania. Welcome, Saul.
Good morning, Zane. Thank you for having me on the program.
Oh, thanks for coming on. It's, really good to have you with us. So, there's been a lot of coverage in the media lately claiming that the... quoting Geoffrey Watson, who's been part of the administration of the CFMEU, Geoffrey Watson has claimed that out of the $100 billion big build here in Victoria, around $15 billion of that was money misappropriated by the CFMEU. Now, there was a Guardian article investigating that claim, and you were quoted in that article. And you've looked at a thing called the Engineering Construction Implicit Price Deflator to investigate that claim. Can you explain for listeners what an Engineering Construction Implicit Price Deflator is in layperson's terms?
Well, I'll do my best. It's not necessarily a simple concept, but maybe your listeners will be familiar with governments, politicians, commentators, and economists talking about things like real gross domestic product. And what that means is growth in the volume of goods and services produced in the Australian economy, measured in dollars, but after stripping out the impact of changes in the prices of those goods and services over a period of time, so that in a sense you're measuring volumes rather than values of goods and services. So the statistician, the ABS, on the basis of an enormous number of surveys of businesses, governments and consumers around the country, every quarter compiles estimates of gross domestic product in dollars of the day. We'll get the figures for the December quarter next Wednesday. And they attempt to convert that into real terms by stripping out movements in the prices of all of those goods and services quarter by quarter, year by year. And so you have nominal gross domestic product, which is measured in current dollars, and real gross domestic product, which is measured in the prices of some base period. And the ratio of those two things is the so-called implicit price deflator, in this case of GDP, can be used as a measure of inflation, a broader measure than the consumer price index, which only includes goods and services that consumers buy. For GDP as a whole, it includes prices of the things that we export. It includes prices of the things that businesses and governments buy, as well as consumers. Now, having said that, I hope I can take another step, which is to say that among the many surveys that the Stats Bureau undertakes is of the amount of money spent by businesses and governments around the country on engineering construction. That includes, in particular, infrastructure projects such as highways, railways, airports and bridges, ports. It also includes a good deal of expenditure on mines and gas fields and so forth by companies. But a big part of it is public sector spending on infrastructure projects. And as with GDP or consumer spending, the ABS publishes data on this in both nominal terms, that is dollars of the day, and real terms, that is after extracting movements in prices of the goods and services that go into infrastructure construction. And so we can derive an implicit price deflator of engineering construction activity, which in a sense is a measure of movements in the costs of undertaking this kind of work. And conveniently, the ABS publishes this for every state and territory. So to get cut to the chase, after hopefully that explanation is reasonably clear, This data tells us that over, for example, the period from the December quarter 2014 until the September quarter of 2025, which is the latest data that we have, so that's just over 11 years, the implicit price deflator of engineering construction spending rose by 36.8% in Victoria, which is actually the second lowest increase of any state or territory. Only the ACT, the implicit price deflator of engineering construction, rose by 35%. But, for example, in New South Wales, it rose by 37.4%. In Queensland, by 42.1%. In South Australia, by 43.2%, and in Western Australia by 45.7%. The average for Australia as a whole was 41.7%. That's almost 5 percentage points faster than the corresponding figure for Victoria. Now, none of this proves that Mr. Watson's calculations or allegations are wrong. It doesn't say anything about the extent or lack thereof of corruption in any part of the construction industry in Victoria. What it does tell you is that the inflation of construction costs on engineering projects has been, you know, by a reasonably wide margin, lower in Victoria than it has nationally, and a bit lower in Victoria than in New South Wales, which I suppose is Victoria's principal competitor for these things.
Yeah, so you've said that it can't tell us anything about Watson's report. I've got an interest to declare here. I'm a CFMEU member. Okay, I tend to disagree a little bit, because I would have thought if the CFMEU has pushed up, we're talking about a $100 billion big build, and so presumably that $100 billion big build would have only cost $85 billion were it not for the unsavoury hand of the CFMEU on those jobs. I mean, I would have thought that if these 10 to 30% price increases that Watson alleges were there, I would have thought that that would register on this engineering construction implicit price.
It might. All I'm saying to you, Zane, is I don't know, and these figures don't prove one way or the other. I mean, one other possibility could be that the cost of labour, for example, in Victoria may have risen by more than in other states on construction projects, and businesses have had to absorb that into their profit margins if they've signed fixed price contracts with the Victorian government that don't allow them to pass increases in those sort of costs on to taxpayers in the form of the Victorian government. These figures don't tell us that. I did look to see if you can find data on movements in labour costs or wages on engineering construction projects or for construction more broadly by state, and those don't appear to be available. So that doesn't answer the question. I guess, you know, the bottom line, as far as I'm concerned, and as I say, I'm not in a position to offer an opinion one way or the other on the extent of corruption or any other kind of malpractice in Victoria or any other state. All I can say is the data tells me that engineering construction costs have risen by less in Victoria than any other jurisdiction except the ACT, and over a 14-year period by about 5 percentage points less than the national, sorry, an 11-year period, by about 5 percentage points less than the average for all states and territories.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I think it's certainly a very relevant contribution to this discussion that you've raised. So thank you for that. Now, while we've got you on the line, I've spoken to some other CFMEU members, and one of the points that they raised is that when the Andrews government was elected back in, I think it was maybe late 2014.
That's why I picked 2014 as the starting point for these calculations, yes.
Yeah, so there's, I guess, as a socialist, but this is not a unique perspective to socialists, this is also a kind of a liberal or a social democratic approach to things. As population grows over time, you need to build infrastructure to keep up: hospitals, schools, roads, rail, train stations, etc. One critique that we would have is that over the last probably 40 years in the era of neoliberalism, there's been a reduction of progressive taxation and an associated reduction in investment in necessary infrastructure compared to like the post-war period from the, say, 1950s through till the late 70s. And so one of the points that a fellow CFMEU member raised was that when the Andrews government was elected, it's almost like they tried to catch up on decades of underinvestment in infrastructure, and they ran all these projects concurrently, and that created a need for labour, and which probably meant that the thing was a bit more expensive than it might otherwise have been. Can you comment on this question of under-investing in infrastructure over many decades and then trying to catch up? Is that a good idea?
I think there's a fair bit of truth in what you say there, Zane, although I'd note that under-investment in infrastructure crossed party lines, if I can call it that, but say from the mid-1980s until about the global financial crisis, public investment as a share of Australia's economy declined quite significantly. And that was partly because that was an era when interest rates were relatively high. And so the cost of borrowing, which has in Australia been the traditional way that governments pay for infrastructure, and that's not necessarily wrong because infrastructure benefits future generations as well as the current one. And so it's appropriate that future generations meet some of the costs of providing long-lived infrastructure by servicing and repaying debt rather than imposing the entire burden on the current generation of citizens and taxpayers. But because interest rates rose very significantly in the 80s and 90s, and although they came down in the early 2000s, the impact of the big rises in interest rates over the previous 20 years still coloured people's thinking, irrespective of which side of politics they were on. That made it more expensive to finance government infrastructure projects and made governments more cautious about it. And I emphasise that probably the epitome of that was the Labor government of Bob Carr in New South Wales, which in particular put restrictions and sought to cut back public sector infrastructure spending and in various other ways also restricted the supply of housing. You know, Bob Carr's argument was that Sydney was full and therefore migration to the whole of Australia should be cut back because it's quite common for people from Sydney to think that what matters for Sydney should determine what happens in the rest of Australia as well. That changed. That attitude did start to change after the global financial crisis, when governments, again irrespective of their political persuasion, saw it as appropriate to help prevent the onset of a depression by increasing public spending, and then interest rates came down to very low levels. And again, both Liberal and Labor governments started to be willing to borrow more in order to spend more on infrastructure. And the then governor of the Reserve Bank, Philip Lowe, was quite explicit in encouraging state governments to borrow more and spend more on infrastructure, which almost all of them did. And I think, you know, the people you've been speaking to are right to say that there has been an element of catch-up to make up for backlogs in infrastructure spending, and that almost certainly contributed to the pressure on both labour and materials costs that contribute to that, you know, overall fairly significant increase in the price of engineering construction activity across Australia. That was a big increase, and it does reflect pressures on the availability of both labour and materials to undertake that work. The criticism I probably have, Zane, of infrastructure projects in Victoria and some other places is that I think governments, again, of both political persuasions, have been far too secretive about the business case for undertaking some of these things. I think when taxpayers' money is being spent, the public is entitled to know the basis on which some projects have been chosen and others have been rejected. There ought to be a benefit-cost analysis of any project like this. Some benefits are often hard to quantify, and that's okay. Elected governments are entitled to make those judgments, but I think they ought to be more forthcoming with citizens about the reasons why they pick particular projects and reject others than governments of all political persuasions have been in recent years. Too much is commercial in confidence. Mm. Too much is redacted, and not enough information is shared with the public so that they in turn can make judgments at elections as to whether governments have been good stewards of their money.
Mm. Certainly. All right, well, we are running short of time, but thank you very much for joining us this morning. And it was good to hear you dunking on Bob Carr and the attitudes of some Sydney people. We like that here at 3CR.
Well, that's been a pleasure, Zane. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Thank you. So, Saul Eslake there, again, independent economist, consultant, speaker, and vice chancellor's fellow at the University of Tasmania. We're getting towards the very tail end of the show. Very briefly, there's an article on the front page of today's Melbourne Age. Activists' anti-Zionist chant ruled hate speech. Palestinian activist Hash Tayyeh incited hatred against Jews when he led a chant of "all Zionists are terrorists" at a Melbourne protest in March last year, the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal has found. I think that ruling is absolutely disgusting, and I would simply hark back to the talk by Guy Galore that we had earlier this morning. The idea that you can't say that Zionism is an offensive and warlike ideology, and that it's anti-Semitic to do so, that is just outrageous, and I cannot believe that ruling. That is ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. All the solidarity to Hash, and I think this is a massive attack on the Palestine movement. All right, well, we're getting to the end of our program. I'd like to thank all our listeners and guests for being on our program this week. I just want to make a bit of a plug that next week will be a special International Women's Day program, and we've actually got quite a good program kind of getting... We're getting a great program kind of lined up with different... hearing from women's voices. I hope listeners tune in next Friday for the special International Women's Day program. But yeah, thanks again for tuning in this week. It's another great week of Radical Radio, and stay tuned for Left After Breakfast. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1-800-634-206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of Khan. Away with all your superstitions. Serve all masses.
Arise.
We'll
change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. That's right, the commies are back. Reds underneath your beds and that crack.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.